John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, June 4th, 2012. Palestinian dies of wounds sustained Friday in the Gaza Strip, and in the West Bank, Israeli settlers burn farmlands. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Two Palestinians were injured on Monday at dawn when the Israeli Air Force bombarded a milk factory in Gaza City, causing excessive damage. Local sources from Gaza said the factory, which was bombarded five times in the past, belongs to the Lul family and is located in a Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City. Furthermore, the army fired shells into open areas near Jabal Rayis in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. No injuries were reported. On Monday before dawn, Palestinian fighter identified as Saraka Rashad Kdeh of the Salah al-Din Brigades, the armed wing of the Popular Resistance Committees, died of wounds suffered Friday when the Israeli military bombarded Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Fawzi Kdeh was also killed in the same Friday's attack, and a third resident was wounded and remains in serious condition. Israeli sources reported Monday that two firebombs were hurled at a home that belongs to Jewish settlers in Maale Hatzitim settlement in Ras Al Amud Palestinian neighborhood in occupied East Jerusalem. Israeli police spokesperson Lou Basamri stated that the incident took place late on Sunday at night and added that the impact caused property damage but no injuries. In the meantime, Israeli sources said a shell was fired into the Sha'ar HaNegev Regional Council in the western Negev, causing no damage and no injuries. A number of fundamentalist Israeli settlers burned on Monday morning Palestinian farmlands planted with wheat east of Yatta City near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Coordinator of the Popular Committee Against the War on Settlements in Yatta, Ratib al-Jabour, reported that burnt lands are located in Sha'b al-Batn and belong to resident Khalid Musa al-Najjar. In 2002, al-Jabour was shot and seriously injured by settler fire and was hospitalized for 3 months. He voiced an appeal to human rights groups to intervene and act of stopping the escalating attacks carried out by extremist settlers in the occupied Palestinian territories, including occupied East Jerusalem. In numerous and escalating attacks, settlers burned Palestinian farmlands, orchards, cut and uprooted olive orchards, in addition to flooding farmlands with wastewater. That's all from IMEMC News. This was the Monday, June 4th daily roundup news from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Qassis and me, George Ishmael.
Hunger strikes by Palestinian prisoners held in administrative detention inside Israel are nothing new, but extended hunger strikes undertaken in 2011 and this year have garnered more media attention in the U.S. than previous prison campaigns. The latest hunger strikes were undertaken to demand an end to harsh restrictions put in place after Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit was taken prisoner in 2006 by members of Hamas and held in Gaza for 5 years. But even after a deal was struck last October for Shalit's release in exchange for more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, the onerous conditions in Israeli prisons remained in place. Restrictions included the prolonged isolation of prisoners, a ban on visits from family members from Gaza and some from the West Bank, and the exclusion of reading and academic study materials. Hunger strikers also demanded an end to administrative detention, where many Palestinian prisoners were held without charge or trial for a set period, often to be rearrested upon their release. Risking damage to their health and even death, individuals carried out hunger strikes ranging from 66 to 77 days. Many now face severe health challenges as they recover. All told, 1,500 prisoners participated in the hunger strike from early spring to mid-May. An agreement between the hunger strikers and Israeli authorities was announced on May 14th. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sahir Francis, a human rights lawyer and director of Adamar, the Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association based in Ramallah in the West Bank. She describes what concessions were won by the hunger strikers and the effectiveness of nonviolent resistance to the Israeli occupation.
Of course, the prisoners, they were using all the time since the beginning of the occupation, the hunger strike as one tool of their resistance inside the prison when they fail to guarantee their basic rights through negotiations with the prison authorities. And it was their method in the past to guarantee the basic rights that they got as prisoners. And actually, in the last years, since the beginning of the Second Intifada, we can say, there's a big retreat in all these rights. The prison authorities started to impose more restrictions and commit more violations against the prisoners till the case of Shalit, the arrest of Shalit, and then things were deteriorating seriously, actually. And this is what led the prisoners in this time to demand, firstly, not the political demands that they were always putting there, connecting it to the end of the occupation and their release, but this time they were concentrating more on the humanitarian aspect of their imprisonment, the conditions, the daily conditions and the life conditions and their dignity in the prisons. And of course, it doesn't mean that they forget or they undermine the main issue, because as well the whole activities, the local civil society action that was supporting the Prisoners Act was all the time putting this issue of the prisoners with the big context of the occupation, that the release of all the prisoners should come with the end of the occupation, of course, and the issue of the prisoners is part of all the question of the occupation, and you cannot do negotiations, for example, without solving the issue of the prisoners. So I think it's very important part in the civil society movement and in the public struggle against the occupation. It was joint as well with, for example, the activism against the wall and the settlements. In most of the demonstrations, the weekly demonstrations that takes place, they were supporting the prisoners' case in the time of the hunger strike, and they were requesting to respect the demands of the prisoners and to free all the political prisoners.
Sahar Francis, was there a demand to get rid of administrative detention altogether? Was that ever on the table?
Actually, this was a complicated, problematic issue because in the agreement, we never get a document of the written agreement. And at the end, it was an agreement between the Egyptian mediators and the Israeli side. The administrative detention, it was not ending the whole use of administrative detention, but rather limiting and using the administrative detention just in a very serious security issues. And not to extend the detention if they don't have a very serious information. Because, you know, the administrative detention is built on secret information. And Israel is using it in a very wide way. And this is why we claim that this is arbitrary detention. It's not illegal according to the international law, of course. The Fourth Geneva Convention gives some space for the occupiers to use administrative detention or arrest without a trial. But there's lots of restrictions in the international law that Israel is not limiting itself to it when practicing the administrative detention. But unfortunately, from the last 2 weeks, tens of detainees that their detention was extended and their administrative detention, and the new detainees that they were transferred for administrative detention. So we are not sure that Israel really is restricting the use of administrative detention as it was agreed in the agreement in the hunger strike time.
Do the Palestinian prisoners, and does your organization, Ademir, that supports these prisoners' rights, consider this latest hunger strike a success?
It was a good result, and we look at it as a good achievement for the prisoners' movement. But still, as I said before, we have to monitor and to be following closely how this agreement would be implemented, because we can't trust fully the Israeli side that really they will fulfill all the demands without any problems. And this is why we are still monitoring closely what's going on.
That was Sahir Francis of Ademar, the Palestinian Prisoners' Rights Organization. Find links to additional information on the Palestinian hunger strike and Israeli prison conditions on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan, Sunday, the British military is reporting the death of a British soldier from small arms fire in Nahr-e Siraj district, Helmand Province. Pakistan reported today a pair of U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan attempted to kill al-Qaeda's number two commander, killing at least 12 other people in Pakistan. According to the Washington Post, it is unknown if the drone bombings killed their intended target at all. Afghanistan, Friday. A suicide truck bomber blasted forward operating base Salerno, which is run by U.S. forces. Initial reports are that 7 Afghans were killed and 13 wounded, but another report claims only 3 attackers were killed as they stormed the base to follow up on the bomb attack. Mr. Barack Obama, this has been going on for years. What makes you think this year or the next will be any different? Now is the time to pull the plug, throw in the towel, bring all the troops home today. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
What began as organized opposition against an 82% rise in university tuition in Canada's Quebec province developed first into a student strike and now has grown into a full-blown social protest movement in sync with anti-austerity activists across the globe. A student boycott of classes, initiated in mid-February, grew to over 166,000 students on strike across the province by the end of March. Swelling numbers of students and their supporters have participated in more than a dozen weeks of protest rallies and marches, with over 300,000 taking to the streets of Montreal on March 22nd. But after Quebec's provincial government passed Emergency Bill 78, which limits the right of free speech and dissent, nearly 400,000 people marched in Montreal in deliberate defiance of the Liberal Party government of Jean Charest's attempt to suppress the student movement. The three main student groups organizing the strike have been joined in the streets in recent weeks by opposition parties, unions, and hundreds of Quebec lawyers. While negotiations between the students and government have recently resumed, police continue to crack down on protesters, with over 2,500 people arrested since the strike began in February. Your reporter spoke with Andrew Gavin Marshall, an independent researcher and writer based in Montreal, who provides analysis and context for understanding the Quebec student strike and its connections with anti-austerity movements worldwide.
The government had announced a 75 to 83% increase in the cost of tuition, nearly doubling our current cost. And in Quebec, we have the lowest tuition in the country, and actually on the continent. We pay an average of $2,500 a semester compared to $5,000 in the rest of Canada, and in the United States, even far more extreme than that. But we also have half the student debt as the rest of Canada, which has an undergraduate average of $27,000, whereas Quebec is $13,000. In the United States, the average undergraduate debt is about $24,000. So the increased tuition cost would obviously nearly double the debt cost. And this is what really mobilized the student associations here against the tuition increases. And the student associations here in Quebec function a little differently than across the rest of Canada and in the United States. They don't really function like our so-called democratic governments, where you simply elect officials every few years and they do whatever they want. Here, the major student associations function through direct democracy. So there are general assemblies, there are discussions, debates, and that the constituents themselves have to vote and make the actual decision. So the representatives simply carry them out. They're not really officials, they're just truly representative. And so when this issue is put before the student associations and their constituents, in large part, students voted to strike. And the strike began back in February. It even included certain student associations at Anglophone schools here in Quebec, which is a French-speaking province. This is really the issue that sparked the movement. And students became engaged, were protesting consistently in Montreal, the city where I live. There have been over 200 protests in the past over 100 days. For the first 2 months of the protest, the government simply refused to even speak to the students. They refused to negotiate. They refused to even consider negotiating. And so the students had to change. And through civil disobedience, they were targeting economic centers in the city, such as a sit-in on a major industrial bridge, which brings in economic goods in and out of the city every day. Consistently, the student protesters have been met with state violence and state repression on a weekly basis, if not a daily basis. You would hear and see and experience protesters, peaceful protesters, being met with tear gas, pepper spray, concussion grenades, smoke bombs, beatings with batons, even having cars and trucks driven into them, shot with rubber bullets. We've had several students who have almost been killed by being shot in the face with rubber bullets, the face or the head. One student lost an eye, another student lost his vision, another student lost some teeth, and another student ended up in a coma with a skull fracture and brain contusion. And especially since Bill 78 was passed, which severely restricts the rights to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, as guaranteed by the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedom, this has really mobilized the good majority of the population against this bill. And so it's no longer students protesting. You see elderly people, you see children, you see strollers, you see wheelchairs, you see an incredible diversity and array of people every single night. It's truly no longer about tuition, it's about our very freedom, and the whole population is mobilizing behind this at the moment.
As you understand it, what are the students' demands here? Do they want the complete abolition of the tuition increase, or is there some middle ground you think that could achieve some settlement of this massive strike?
Well, the student association, I mean, there's three main ones. All of the main student associations agree that the hikes should be stopped, although there's some indication from the representative of the college student association that they are willing to allow for some hike. And in terms of a potential agreement or middle ground, I mean, certainly there are possibilities when it comes to the tuition issue. But so long as Bill 78 remains in place, this will have no support from students, and the students will vote against any agreement that does not rescind or repeal Bill 78.
How important is international solidarity with the student movement in Quebec? I've read about protests in Europe, Latin America, Taiwan, and of course here in the United States. Where do you think the links between the student movement and Quebec could take an international movement of students?
The international solidarity is absolutely necessary, and it gives such incredible hope to the students here. I mean, it really started to sprout up at a time right when we were being so destroyed, and it really gave the students here strength. We saw solidarity protests in Toronto, in Vancouver, in Calgary, in New York, organized by Occupy Wall Street, in Paris. There is a student movement entering its first year anniversary in Chile, which we here are learning from. The massive disparity in political, social, and economic structures of power are not only in Quebec. These are global issues. These are global challenges, and they require mobilizing the global population against them. And the faster it spreads, the more it spreads, the more globally it spreads, the better for everyone involved.
That was Andrew Gavin Marshall, an independent researcher and writer based in Montreal, Canada. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org to find links to additional news and commentary on Quebec's student movement.
For over 3 months, Quebec, Canada has been in an uproar. A student strike against higher tuition in Montreal erupted into a province-wide uprising in the face of police repression. Police attacks on students banging pots and pans caused that tactic to spread, with residents responding to calls to bang pots and pans all over Montreal and elsewhere in Quebec. Some have called this tactic the People's LRAD, comparing it to the sound cannon used on protesters by police at the Pittsburgh T-20 and by whalers against Sea Shepherd. On the 1st of June, in a pounding thunderstorm, about 30 people from Occupy DC marched on the Canadian Embassy in solidarity with a student strike and the larger uprising. Here's what they had to say at the Canadian Embassy. We got an event going on inside. This noise will storm the building. Even if protesters can't get in. This sound should bounce off the back wall.
Sisters in Canada,
with our brothers and sisters in Canada,
and all around the world,
and all around the world,
struggling for their rights, to education,
education
should not come with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt,
that is not happening in America.
stand here today
to say that the symbol of my country for me is not this crest. That sits on the desk of Stephen Harper. It's a red square.
That sits on the clothing
of my brothers and sisters.
In Montreal.
Oh, Canada, you can't fight your way out of this one with truncheons and billy clubs. That didn't work at the Toronto G20 in 2010, and sure as hell won't work in Quebec with its long history of independence movements. On the 31st of May, several hundred D.C. residents and union members gathered at 801 New Jersey Avenue Northwest, one of the proposed sites for Walmart in D.C. They marched from there to Walmart's D.C. lobbying headquarters at 701 8th Street Northwest. The star float in the parade was a truck-mounted bed with D.C. flag covers, and on top was someone dressed D.C. Mayor Gray and someone wearing a Walmart smiley face. Meanwhile, people dressed as council members Brown, Bowser, and Alexander passed out piles of fake campaign cash that doubled as anti-Walmart leaflets. When the parade arrived at Walmart's 701 8th Street D.C. offices, here's what people had to say.
Retail is one of the few sectors in the country that is still growing and creating jobs. People don't get rich on it, but people like to join in Safeway, buy homes, put their kids in college. Walmart can't say that. Walmart can't do that. The reason that John and Safeway can do that, the workers there, are because they have unions. Walmart is a union buster. They don't allow unions. They don't allow their workers a free choice.
All right, Kobe Schiff, Vice President, National Organization of Women. Amen. All right.
For women. I'm the membership vice president, and I just want to let you all know, NOW is here with you. From Seattle to Alabama, from New York to Chicago, NOW women are on the ground, ready, able, grounded, with our sign, ready to take a stand against Walmart. But I also want to let you know, this is not a new fight for us. We declared Walmart a merchant of shame in 2002 when we found out that they had discriminatory practices against women.
Representative's reply was, "Oh yes, ma'am, we cover experimental, but Walmart's policies don't. Walmart, you did it again. You sold me cheesy, substandard health insurance. After several months and numerous rounds of radiation treatments went by, I finally went back to work to overhear the manager's stress at a meeting that our store was to get rid of 100 employees. It was very clear that his goal was to save on wages and benefits by hiring part-time employees."
Mr. Mayor, hundreds of people came out on the last day of May asking you to put an end to those backroom deals with Walmart. If you were to be Walmart's back door into the city, you just might turn out to be a one-term mayor just like Adrian Fenty.
Break on through to the other side,
On the 4th of June, Occupy Our Home staged a multi-pronged invasion
of the Loan Modification Office of J.P. Morgan Chase. One group, including retired D.C. EMT paramedic Deborah Harris, walked into the office to demand that Chase and Freddie Mac cease and desist efforts to foreclose on her home. Another protested in the office, and a third contingent covered them by storming the lobby after marching over from Freddie Mac. Go.
Wow.
Here we go. Two groups
protesting or speaking? The smaller group, which is the first group, is inside the office of the manager's office negotiating.
Oh, yeah, there's
one. And the second group is in Chase Bank's office, just picketing, I guess.
And then there's a...
Sweet. And so all this is a diversion that covered them.
Yes.
Sweet.
For about 2 hours now.
For about 2 hours now.
While J.P. Morgan continues to lose money, they continue to ignore,
our friend,
Deborah.
So I think,
it's important
that we stay here,
until she has the modification,
because we know,
the banks,
only care about Jamie Diamond and his BFFs.
Police made no arrests even though occupiers blocked the doors. And finally, after about 2 hours out front, with protesters having entered the lobby and a second group of protesters having been upstairs, after 3 hours of waiting, Deborah Harris finally got her meeting with the officials of J.P. Morgan Chase. They agreed to work with her to modify her mortgage. They better not try to go back on that deal, or Occupy's gonna be back.
Guys, form a big
sit down and they talk to me. It was where they stand, that they will go to find Freddie Mac and tell them to find out what's going on and how they will try to help me out in order to get me a modification and everything. So that's what I believe that they were telling me. So I told them, don't be making promises to me, because I've had to wait since 2009 to get something done. And I also found out a lady in the office said that if she had known that my house had been in notification in 2009, she said, why did they didn't tell you that they had an office down here that I could have came down here and got that modification done in 2009. I've been in my house ever since 2009, December 2009, and now they was going to wait until this year to put me out of my house. So Chase was saying that they're going to do an investigation. They're going to call the lawyer for Freddie Mac and find out what's going on so they can try to work with me and keep me abreast every day of what's going on. That's the only thing I can do, y'all. Thank you for everyone that's come out for my support.
Thank you.
The only thing we can do is just wait and see exactly what's going on. I told them, please don't promise me. Don't promise me that you're going to do something. Do it. No, that's all I want you to do. And I also know that if it wasn't for y'all being here, Occupy Home DC being here, they would have brushed me off. They would have not paid me any attention. They would have just said, well, she's just another little DC resident that's trying to get her home.
In case you couldn't hear that, what Deborah's worried about is that those crooks at J.P. Morgan Chase will deal with her only long enough to get Occupy out of their office, then go back on their promise to modify her mortgage. But they better think twice about that, because if they play that game, Occupy will be back. On the 4th of June, Occupy Our Homes invaded and then protested outside the office of J.P. Morgan Chase, demanding that they modify a mortgage held by retired D.C. paramedic and EMT Deborah Harris instead of foreclosing on her. She suffered a career-ending injury, and the thanks she got for 23 years of saving lives was a threat of foreclosure in until Occupy Our Homes held the bank's feet to the fire and forced them to agree to work with her to modify her loan. While Deborah was inside haggling with J.P. Morgan Chase and protesters blocked the doors from outside, D.C.'s own Reverend Hagler told everyone how people of faith finding the homes of banking executives and CEOs were able to force the big banks to work with the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America to modify tens of thousands of mortgages.
There's been a group called the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, or NACA. And we've been moving all across the country doing home save events. And when I say home save events, it's because we've been moving working people into being able to purchase a home the right way. When I say the right way meant that we force the lenders to pay closing costs, and we basically put people in their homes a percentage point below the market at 100% loan to value. And they were exempt from private mortgage insurance. They were exempt from all the other scams that happened. And the reality is all of our folks basically stayed in their homes. We're safe in their homes. And so we moved to deal with this meltdown by doing modifications. We left Washington, D.C. about 4 weeks ago. We saw over 58,000 people at the convention center here in Washington, D.C. Then we went after that to Richmond. We saw over 50,000 people in the Richmond area being there a weekend. We went to Atlanta. We saw 70,000 people in Atlanta. We're going to San Antonio. San Antonio, and then Cleveland after that. And basically what we've been doing is taking people and saying that give us a budget of what you can afford. If your property's underwater, we have exclusive contracts with the lenders that we can basically take principal off the table and lower the interest rate so that somebody can fit in and be able to comfortably stay in their home and that be fixed for the rest of the mortgage. We did that. How did we do that? Well, it didn't start out by sitting down and simply having a conversation with the lenders. We found out where some of the CEOs live. And we went to their homes. And they tried to block us from some of their summer homes in Long Island. We rented rafts and got on their property by way of sea.
Yeah.
We wanted to let them know that they could not run away from our moral demands. And so one by one, the lenders signed contracts with us. Not because they love us, but because we did the research. We found out where their children went to school. We found out what country club they hung out in. We found out where their mama lived. And we showed up, and we showed up, and we hounded them, and we made it personal. It wasn't about Chase. It was about Debbie Diamond.
Yes.
It wasn't about any of the other corporations. It was personally about those CEOs. Why was it personally? Because they made it personal. Yes. They made it personal when they put people out of their homes. Those are real names and faces. And so we had to take the battle and make it a very personal battle in order for these folks to understand that we have taken this seriously and it's personal and we're going to deal with it in a personal fashion.
Yes. Yes.
Now, the fact is, I'll say that as we continue to do the advocacy, because NACA's an advocacy organization and you're an advocacy group, continue to do the advocacy. That is needed. We got to keep this lifted up. But also, as you know, people who are having difficulty, send them to our website, NACA.com. NACA.com. And under tabs that says Home Save, they can begin the process of getting their mortgages modified and affordable.
That's what I call getting results. And it all worked because the CEOs and senior executives of the banks really didn't want to have protesters from the churches coming out to their homes, coming to their weddings, and other high-profile public events. Direct Action gets the goods, Squeaky Wheel gets the grease. Don't let the bankers intimidate you into giving up your home. Organize and get together with your neighbors and those you trust the most. Hold their feet to the fire and
together we can defend our homes. On the 5th of June, Occupy Our Homes received words that U.S. Marshals were going to evict Dawn Butler from 917 Maryland Avenue Northeast between 8 a.m. and noon. Occupiers mobilized to defend the home, succeeded in delaying the eviction, but were met by a mixed team of D.C. police and U.S. Marshals, including a backup team with automatic weapons. One occupier was arrested, and police threw occupiers down the masonry stairs. It has been confirmed that one was knocked out and seriously injured.
Oh shit, Lash got injured.
They threw him across. They threw him down the stairs.
Alright, I'll be right back. I'm gonna run around. We got many injured over here. We got one seriously injured. That was Mark. I think he's unconscious. Shit. I am at 917 Maryland Avenue, Northeast DC. Lash, what is the badge number?
I know who he is. I know who he is.
What's the badge number?
U.S. Marshal.
Oh, U.S. Marshal?
I know who he is.
They don't have fucking badge numbers on there, so.
They don't have badge numbers. That's the purpose of it. Like, these two right here are going to tase a motherfucker on the curb. Like I have been tased. I've been tased twice in the cab going through the cab.
I got 59 viewers right now, so.
Him right here.
That guy right there? Yeah. He has to throw Eli down on the rock. Hurt his back.
There was also a report that the movers broke many possessions in the process of clearing the house. This should be presumed deliberate retaliation for the defense of the home. This action still forced the eviction to drag on past the noon legal deadline with unknown legal consequences. A previous eviction defense of the same location some months ago held off the marshals until noon, at which point they could no longer come on that day. This is not the same home Occupy Our Homes was defending on Monday, the 4th of June, with the occupation of J.P. Morgan Chase. That home belongs to Deborah Harris. Right now, Occupy Our Homes still stands at 2 out of 3 in defending homes from foreclosure evictions. How long are we going to put up with U.S. Marshals acting like bulls on parade with automatic weapons when the bankers want your home? Are they going to push this until they get another incident like MOVE in 1985 or Waco, Texas in 1993? Already defenders of a home have been wounded in action against the U.S. Marshals in Northeast D.C. Here is the backstory as reported by Sarah Shaw on the illegal eviction of Dawn Butler from 917 Maryland Avenue Northeast. Dawn Butler is a tenant in D.C. Her landlord went into foreclosure when he was hospitalized for cancer treatment. D.C. has a right of first refusal law, which means that the tenant has a right to take over the mortgage from the landlord. The landlord is more than willing to allow Dawn to do this. However, the holding company and the banks have refused her this right. 30th of May, the National Park Service announced plans to use so-called sharpshooters from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to kill up to 3/4 of all deer at Rock Creek Park. They plan to shoot on winter nights, closing off sections of the park to make way for the slaughter. The USDA also shoots and poisons wolves and other predators out west to make cattle ranching more profitable. So killing animals comes easily to them. The Park Service says a population of about 80 deer per square mile is too many, and it may be unsustainable. The only thing is, that's coming from us humans, a species with a population density of about 6,000 per square mile in D.C., complaining that an 80 per square mile of some other species is too many. Such hypocrisy. And deer are not the only thing that can harm Rock Creek Park. They say deer are a hazard to motorists, but some say the same about pedestrians and bicyclists. In fact, if we can call deer for eating too much of Rock Creek, why don't we call SUVs for polluting the creek with oil and antifreeze and the air was exhaust. There are a lot more cars than deer in Rock Creek. Just what is the National Park Service smoking? To think the most destructive animal on earth, ourselves, has any jurisdiction whatsoever over deer, when there are 75 people for every deer on a population density basis around D.C. Okay? So the deer eat so much that the park is suffering. What do you think the huge amount of land that has to be cleared to support the meat-heavy U.S. diet is doing to the land as a whole? For that matter, runoff from lawn services, lawn chemicals, is probably doing more damage to Rock Creek than deer excrement ever will. It's time to get real and tell the pot to stop calling the kettle an iron casting.